Exciting. And again, we welcome all of you. My name is Charles Marsh, and I teach in the Religious Studies Department and direct the Project on Lived Theology here at the University of Virginia. I'm thrilled to have one of our distinguished doctoral graduates, who's now a professor of religious studies at Ashland University in Ohio, come back to his alma mater and talk to us about his research on religion and congregations and race in the Deep South. Some of this comes from his dissertation here at UVA, which was published in, 2006?
Nine.
In this, by Oxford University Press, in this really terrific, very readable, extremely helpful volume, Open Friendship in a Closed Society, Mission Mississippi and the Theology of Friendship. Pete may also draw on some of the research he's been doing over the past 2 years in the context of a writing grant from the Project on Lived Theology on the relation between worship, music, and race, again, using the Southern Theater as his landscape. I am thrilled you're here. My great honor to have Pete as my first doctoral student here at UVA. I met Pete, it must have been somewhere around 1998-99. I was giving a reading at Square Bookstore in Oxford, Mississippi, and you happened to be finishing up your master's degree at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture in Oxford, and came to the book talk, which was a talk on a book on religion and civil rights, and stood up in the back and said, "So you, Professor Marsh, you wrote your doctoral dissertation on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and you've been doing this civil rights stuff for 3 or 4 or 5 years. What does Bonhoeffer have to do with civil rights?" And I was like, "Okay, let's talk." And later on that evening, around the square in Oxford, We did speak at length, and I invited you to come on to Charlottesville, where you finished your doctoral dissertation here, receiving numerous prestigious research grants, a really creative and very skilled organizer in helping the Project on Lived Theology get established here at UVA, skills and organizational prowess that run right to these two people here, Nathan and Kelly Fogora-Ray. So we're thrilled to have you back. And one other thing, you're not from Mississippi, I guess.
I'm not from around here.
Okay. Pete did his undergraduate degree at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and there, before he did a Southern Studies degree in Mississippi, wrote his undergraduate thesis on Bonhoeffer. And I guess maybe you could tell us sometime today what Bonhoeffer has to do with Southern studies and ethnography and the Mississippi Delta. But it's wonderful having you here. So thanks for coming.
Well, hang on. Thank you very much, Charles.
When Pete first came to Trinity Church, he told people that he had an Oxford accent. He was from Oxford, Mississippi, and that he had an Oxford accent.
That's true. Well, thanks very much for inviting me here. This is an event that kind of grew in the telling, a bit like that introduction. That's a very good example, by the way, where if you're doing oral histories, they're very good for color, but you need to check them with some print sources, because Charles conflated two different events together and then relocated them into an evening event on the square, because I think you like food, right?
Yeah,
we have been on the square together later, so...
Were there two events there?
Yeah, but that doesn't... It's not really important right now, but... I went to Charles's book talk at Square Books when he was promoting God's Long Summer, and I went up to him afterwards and got the book signed, and I went back and looked at the book, and he put his email address in there. I wondered, do you do that for everybody?
No,
apparently not. So when Charles invited me to come here, he said, "Oh, it's very informal. You're going to, they'll just read some stuff from your book, and we'll just sit around and talk about it." And then a few weeks ago, Kelly contacted me and said, "What's the title?" I said, "The title?" She goes, "For the poster." I was like, "The poster for the informal talk?" She goes, "Well, it's open to the public." I was like, "Oh, okay. So then yesterday I talked to Charles, and he said, now, they will have just written the paper, so they probably won't have done any of the reading. So the whole notion of, like, a nice discussion around what you read just kind of flew out the window at that point. And then I arrived today, and there was a camera. So this whole thing has sort of escalated completely out of control. Charles did, set me up on the online teaching tool thing that you have here. And he said, don't change any of the grades. And I had a look around there, and then I realized something else which was slightly terrifying, which is that this is the last kind of class lecture-y thing that you have this semester before you do your presentations. So apparently I'm supposed to wrap this whole thing up as well and give it some meaning. And so I was thinking about that, and it actually helped me because I've tried to do book talks before or talk about kind of my research, and there's just too much of it. And you will try and cram too much into too small a space, and it doesn't sort of work. So thinking about how my research relates to the course that you have taken has helped me. And actually hearing you talk about your research has really helped me too. And first of all, I want to say we're all doing the same work. I'm absolutely no different than you. I love going into archives. I love discovering new things. I haven't had the crazy experience, I won't call it an exciting experience, of discovering my family in an archive I wasn't expecting. I did go and spend time with the King Papers at Boston University. And in their archive, it's a beautiful big archive, and you have to put on the white gloves. And I was going through the papers from the Montgomery bus boycott. Charles was trying to see if there was anything that had been left out of the collected papers, and it was an expensive way to find out that absolutely everything is in the collected papers. But there were lots of little loose pieces of paper of the flyers that were put under the windshield wipers of running up to the bus boycott, saying, don't ride the buses on Monday. And they obviously had run too many off, and they were used as scrap paper. And they kept popping up in these folders. And I turned one over, and there were King's notes for the first mass meeting. What he was going to, the running order. So I was like, and there are other people studying who knows what, and I was running around. I was, look at this. I'm wearing white gloves, so it's okay. Look at this. They didn't get as excited as I did, but you would have got excited. So we're all doing the same thing. The first thing I want to do as a way of getting into this, and Charles says you have talked a little bit about this, is thinking about historical narratives, beginnings and endings. Historians, whether they want to admit it or not, are storytellers. And some of them are much more boring about the stories they tell than others. But whether you're a good storyteller or not, historians are storytellers. And so stories have beginnings and endings. And the civil rights movement is often bracketed, you know, is it from Brown versus Board to the Civil Rights Act? Is it the life of, the ministry, public ministry of King, from the bus boycott through to his assassination? And I sort of wanted to ask you guys, I'm going to get you guys to do a little bit of work to start with. What are some of the pros and cons of ending, and I know you've talked a little bit about this, but it'll lead on to another question. What are the pros and cons of sort of ending it maybe 1968? With the assassination of King, the dissolution of the energies of the movement. Some of you have been looking at black power coming out of SNCC. I just want to hear from you. What bringing the story to an end there, is that a good thing? Is that helpful? Is it not helpful? Help me. Yeah.
And so I'd say that once you put an end date on it, it implies that there's nothing, that but there was nowhere else to go, as opposed to just people didn't know where to go because where they thought they were going became unattainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, but in terms of forming that historical narrative, you have to set an end date on it. I think that 68 seems like an appropriate end date, because for me, 68 seems like a year where the civil rights movement, it had already been ruptured several times, but finally it shatters. And there are all these different movements that come out of it that we talked about, the feminist movement, and obviously the anti-war movement, and there are just so many little pieces, and so it's no longer here.
So as if you put the emphasis on civil rights, you don't like it ending in 68 because the struggle for civil rights continues. But if you put the emphasis on civil rights movement, if you want to talk about a particular kind of movement, then maybe understanding its ending is kind of helpful. And when you talk to a lot of activists from that period, they recognize that was a particular time and that things changed and it came to an end. Anyone else want to weigh in? That's interesting. So both kind of points of view. Well, can you remember back to when you started this class, or allegedly if you kept to the syllabus, you thought about theological drama. Do you remember that? Somebody wrote an article called Civil Rights Movement. Oh, it was him. Civil Rights Movement as theological drama. And dramas have beginnings and endings as well. In Charles's article, Civil Rights as Theological Drama, he asks, what would happen if we take the religious truth claims made by participants in the movement seriously? The movement is the playground and the battlefield of these competing claims about humanity, peace, violence, God, and the universe. Which way the universe bends? It's kind of an interesting question. To quote from the article, Charles encourages us to, quote, seek to clarify or explicate theological ideas by observing them in their concrete social settings. And I would add to write about them, to create narratives. This is an interesting picture, by the way. This is Will Campbell, who was a white minister. Some of you may have talked about him in class. One of the most prominent white ministers in SCLC. And that's right after the assassination of King. He comes to Memphis, and there is a photograph of him standing on the spot where King was killed. And I find it very poignant because he's sort of facing the future, and there's a sense of, is this the end? I'm reading way too much into the picture. But so my question is, how does, if we elevate our task to sort of writing theological drama or seeing theological drama, how does the end affect that if we end in 68? It's a tricky question, yeah. I mean, there's something very powerful. Thank you, that was great. There's something very powerful and almost too easily theological to end a story with the kind of the death of the sort of martyrdom of the prophet. I mean, it lends itself to a theological narrative, and maybe we need to be wary of being seduced by that, perhaps. Anyone else got any thoughts about that? Yeah.
Yes, from the... from a non-Christian perspective, with, you know, like the messianism of King, which I've been looking into from a Jewish perspective, as opposed to the, you know, a lot of the Christian perspectives that we've been reading. And I think it gives you a very different idea of, you know, like the death of the Messiah, mm-hmm. And what comes after that. Because, you know, neither of the religions really have an answer for what happens when your Messiah dies, because mm-hmm. it doesn't, you know, like the Messiah doesn't die in theory. So, you know, if you're going from that point, then it kind of has to end because you've lost your Messiah, but there's like nothing to go on from there, at least like religiously.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one of the things that struck me as I was thinking about this, and I've taught a very similar class a number of times and felt this, when one of the things that's very exciting about the civil rights movement to study is it is inspiring. And we want to identify with the characters that we're inspired by. And often that can then kind of translate into that we want to be in some way a part of that. We'd like to find a way to be a part of that movement, even though we're separated by now decades. Sometimes, and it hasn't happened with any of my students, sometimes that can lead to actually quite strange behavior when students or anybody want to feel that sense of confrontation with kind of racism, to relive something that is definitely a historical event. Now, there's obviously racism. Just look at what's going on in Ferguson now. But it's not... Maybe this isn't a point. This is when you're doing a historical narrative, it's important to have certain historical periods end so you can recognize that you're in a new historical period. But I was thinking that maybe a theological drama, on the other hand, is something that requires us to place ourselves, find ourselves in it. So in the article that you wrote, Charles, you talk about when King says, you know, when he talks about nonviolence, and makes these claims about what it means to be Christian in that in a violent context, we still have to work through those now and understand that. In a sense, to be theological for a second, it requires a good eschatology. Because if you see something as theological drama, it's going somewhere. So maybe Will Campbell he's looking out at an eschatological horizon. Certainly a Christian claim and a Jewish claim would be we're not doomed to repeat history. An eschatological view of a theological drama is it's headed somewhere, and we need to find, we can find ourselves in that, maybe, in a way. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about, I want to think about my own research in terms of theological drama. And I was kind of pleased when I looked back at my book and I realized, oh, I sort of did that. And it's a quote, and at the end of my first chapter, I have a fairly extended quote from Will Campbell, who wrote this in 1961. Now, that's before the March on Washington, before the Civil Rights Act. And it's unexpected from a man who's employed by the Liberal National Council of Churches. So this is what he wrote in 1961. As significant as the prophetic edge of the church is, and by prophetic edge of the church he means the churches like Westminster Presbyterian that were, you know, calling for changes to the law. As significant as the prophetic edge of the church is, and as much as most of us regret the present dearth of prophets in the land, it may well be that heroic deeds will come not by the appearance of more and greater prophets, but as God uses the conserving edge, which is, from our point of view, the weakness of the church. And by conserving edge, he's talking about what we would consider the sort of very conservative part of the church. Making the conscious decision to play the conserving role and put our house in order is far from what the church might fairly have been expected to do. And if even this much is done, it is not something of which we can boast, for it will have been that which God has done through us and often despite ourselves. And if it is done, the kingdom will not have come, only the starting point will have been reached. That which was established at Pentecost concerning race will have been realized. So Will Campbell, who I would put up there as being a prophet in his own way, looking forward from the midst of the civil rights movement, saw a continuing theological drama for the church, for conservative churches, and having a particular role to play in this continuing drama, particularly around the question of race and religion. So that's by way of introduction to the work. I've got loads of pieces of paper here. the work that I did. So Charles has talked a little bit about how I came to do research into churches in Mississippi. I went to Mississippi in 1997 because I love blues music and barbecue, and that's absolutely true. I didn't know I loved barbecue, actually, till I got there. That was a great discovery. And found myself in the midst of a very interesting time. The President's Initiative on Race was coming to Oxford, Mississippi. I got involved in helping organize high school students to report to the President's Initiative on Race. I'd been a community development worker for the church in England, and I came to Mississippi to have a break and listen to some great music, and I ended up doing the most interesting community development work that I had ever done. And then that same semester, I met Charles, read his book, had the terrible thought, man, if I ever did a PhD, I'd love to do stuff like this. Ended up here, to cut a very long story short, ended up in Mississippi with my first dissertation proposal absolutely in smoking ruins, thanks to some obstructive gentlemen. And I called Charles. I was like, oh. They said I couldn't have any access to any of the archives. And Charles said, that's okay. Mission Mississippi, that's the story. You need to look at Mission Mississippi. I spent a year. That's another story.
Yeah.
I'll tell that. I may tell that story at the end. But I found myself in Mississippi, and as you can tell from my accent, right, I'm not from around here. And it was a very steep learning curve. As you know, Mississippi gained itself the great title, thanks to historian James Silver, the closed society. And have you talked about this book at all, mentioned it? He was a professor at the University of Mississippi. And he'd been a keen observer of Mississippi society since the 1930s. He was there when the rioting took place with the integration of the university, when James Meredith came on campus. And when he wrote this book, and it was good timing. It hit the shelves right as Freedom Summer was starting, and the headlines hit that the three civil rights workers had gone missing, and became a bestseller. And he has this idea: since the Civil War, Mississippi's whites are on the defensive against inexorable change. They'd developed a closed society with an orthodoxy accepted by nearly everybody in the state. That's great. That shows his perspective. When he says nearly everybody in the state, he means, you know, all the white people. But this stuck. And we're in a different time, but one of the things that stung about this title is people would associate this with the Soviet Union. Soviet Union's the closed society. But the idea that the closed society is, in fact, in America is kind of insulting. You know, got them a bit upset. When I was looking into, I had this phone call with Charles. The real thing is Mission Mississippi. I'll tell you about that, for those of you who didn't do the reading, in a second. And I was trying to figure out an angle in a hurry. And I thought, you know, the angle here is friendship, because their slogan is changing Mississippi one relationship at a time. There's got to be something on friendship. And so what I did is, I did what you guys probably did. I went to Oldman Library, and there's a friendship section. Did you know that? It's where the butterflies are and the rainbows. Actually, it's in the philosophy. And it's actually quite a small section of a bookshelf, which I was relieved to see. And so I was like, I have no idea, but I'm going to start at the beginning. And so I went, this is the great thing about libraries that you don't get online. I just flipped through the books. Down the, and I got to a collection of essays, which included one by Jürgen Moltmann. And the essay was Open Friendship, Aristotelian and Christian Concepts of Friendship. And I started reading it. And I later found out it was a slight reworking of a chapter in this book, The Church and the Power of the Spirit. In this chapter, Moltmann spins an ecclesiology, his understanding of what it means to be church, around the notion of a radical open friendship of the disciples of Jesus, which contrasts with the closed friendships of the closed societies of the 20th century. I practically started shouting in the stacks. I couldn't believe that. I mean, actually, he doesn't use the phrase closed society until right at the end of the chapter. I was willing him to please say closed society by the end. And so I had the title for my dissertation before I really written anything, Open Friendship in a Closed Society. And this idea of openness, he roots in stuff in John's Gospel. I won't go into it, but it's based on it's the opposite of an Augustinian notion of sin. Sin is incurvatus in se, turned in on ourselves. The human is turned in ourselves. As opposed to what Moltmann would see as the kind of openness. And the openness is openness to all kinds of things. Openness to the future. He sees sin makes us very fearful, closed to notions of the future. We defend what we have. We don't open ourselves up. And the more I read this, Moltmann's theology, I either lucked out or Providence was with me in the stacks that day. But the comparisons became stronger and stronger between Mississippi and kind of Moltmann's theology. Oh, and there he is. He's a very friendly chap. That's him sitting in Charles's house. Oh, and then the next crazy stroke of providence. Charles goes, we're going to have a spring institute on lib theology. And our first speaker is going to be Jürgen Moltmann. I was like, you are kidding me. That was totally coincidental. And I couldn't get to speak to him the whole time he was here. And Charles allowed me as a grad student to drive him to the airport. And we drove a really, really long way to the airport. And I was holding my tape recorder with one hand as we went. And he very graciously kept talking. So the other context is, so this is open friendship, closed societies, Mississippi. But this is supposed to be about Mississippi since the Civil Rights Movement, allegedly. That was the title I gave. So the context I found myself in, this is where historical narratives are important, and they end and have new chapters. Mississippi today is very different, thankfully, than the Mississippi of the Civil Rights Movement. The Mississippi today, and I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, is very different than the Mississippi when I was a grad student there in the late 90s. Quite noticeably different in terms of the integration of social spaces, for example. And so there are a few things about Mississippi that make it a really fun case study if what you're interested in is theological drama and thinking about what's going on. And here's why. I did a talk for Mississippi high school students this summer, and so I gave them a pie chart. I was pretty pleased with that. But this is... So it must be true.
Wasn't Mississippi the most religious?
It is. That's my punchline.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm trying to create this.
I know. Well, synthesis.
Openness.
It is. It's very good. Yeah. Well, as you know, Mississippi is very religious. And by very religious, this is a Gallup poll taken in 2013. Gallup classifies Americans as very religious if they say religion is an important part of their daily lives, and that they attend religious services every week, or almost every week. That's very religious. And 61% of Mississippians self-identify as very religious. It makes it the most religious, as you know, the most religious state in... What's the least religious state? The least very religious, whatever that means. I think so, yeah. New Hampshire, I believe. Maybe they don't. Maybe they don't want to... Maybe they don't want to own up to it, yeah, right? So to put this in a little bit of perspective, I don't come from around here. In the United Kingdom, church attendance, people who go ever, is 6%. Okay? That, I mean, you might have gone by accident, but you're not very religious, right? So it's in this context, very religious, hyper-segregated, that we look at. I want to look at Will Campbell's kind of prediction of a theological drama, that is there a place, that a role for these conservative churches after the civil rights movement, the movement has kind of rolled through. And what I found, and I knew these folks existed, I'd gone to various meetings, was this organization called Mission Mississippi. And I just think it's interesting you have the a logo kind of reminiscent of SNCC, with the two hands shaking. We're nothing but professional here. Nothing like it at all. Okay. So I want to just, for those of you who have come along for the first time and those of you who may have glanced at the reading, I'm going to just go very briefly, sort of introduce you to this group. Mission Mississippi started in 1992 as a project of the Christian Businessmen's Committee of Jackson, a group of white evangelical businessmen who were sold the idea of a citywide crusade by evangelist Patrick Morley. These businessmen, most of them white, were smart enough to realize that in a city which was half African-American, if they wanted to reach the city, they needed to involve African-Americans. African-American evangelist Tom Skinner was brought in on the ticket, and an informal interracial group of ministers in Jackson who'd been meeting for several years joined the effort and brought the city's black churches into the effort. In 1993, Mission Mississippi held its first rally in Memorial Stadium. And here's one of the bumper stickers. I'll tell a story for those of you who are into research. I was in Jackson for a whole summer, maybe a couple of months, researching this. And the last week I was there, someone said, you probably want to see the papers. I said, what? Yeah, the papers. Oh, I've got them in my office in a filing cabinet. You should stop by. So this character waited till I was about to leave, and he decided he could trust me. And I get there, and he goes, give me a hand. He carries a filing cabinet into an empty room, and he goes, the photocopy is there, anything you want. So I started photocopying like a maniac. But they had a whole stack of bumper stickers, and I didn't think they'd miss one. So I didn't photocopy that. It's interesting that that Charles gave you the Stone of Hope reading, which talks about the civil rights movement. He casts it, this historical narrative, as a religious revival. And he even makes David Chappelle makes the point that Billy Graham was involved. Martin Luther King was involved with Billy Graham. And so for these evangelicals in Mississippi, the Billy Graham kind of model of crusade, coming in, getting lots of churches involved, doing a big stadium rally, this was their model. And so Mission Mississippi was actually a name for this mission that they were going to have in the stadium. But as you see, it ended up becoming a sort of ongoing movement. But from the start, this is how they differed from a Billy Graham crusade. They had the dual emphasis of evangelism and building friendships between African-American and white Christians. This was rooted in their understanding that Christians, whatever their stripe and hue, have a unity in Christ that should transcend human division. Mission Mississippi wanted its participants to discover this reality and then demonstrate it in public. And I think this is the next PowerPoint slide. This is the this is from their newspaper that they printed for the first rally. And they really love this term, unity. And something that I only realized after I'd written the thing and it was published, and I was reading segregationist sermons. The idea of Christian unity was one of the strong arguments made by segregationist ministers for why the civil rights movement was a bad thing. Jesus brings a spiritual unity. What you're trying to do, civil rights people, is force a kind of human false unity. And so it was very interesting to me that, in a sense, the same argument was being used.
The unity that exists in the global ecumenical...
Global ecumenical church. Or when we die, we will all be united, but now God wants us to be separate. And as I discovered, and as you maybe read a little bit, some of the advisors to Mission Mississippi were the same guys who had been the kind of old wise mentors to this movement. At least two of them had been directors of the Citizens Council in Jackson. So they must have, they were very comfortable with using this language of Christian unity. But it somehow had changed in the intervening time to enable them to think about bringing folks together. I can. The Citizens Council was kind of a bit like the Rotary, a bit like the Rotary Club. You know, if you started in Mississippi, I mean, it's been dubbed the Uptown Klan. But the way it functioned was that the business leaders and leaders in the white community came together to find ways of kind of enforcing segregation, to offer resistance. And so they would, using very similar tools to the civil rights movement, they would boycott white businesses. If you were in white or black, but if you were white and somehow transgressed the Jim Crow lines, you might find the bank pulled your loans right away. And I actually spoke to I digress, but this is sort of, I feel like you guys are researching stuff, and this is how it works. So, as you know, in a great resource in Mississippi, there was a secret police force, the Sovereignty Commission, and it kept files on everybody they were interested in, and it was almost like a news clipping service. And people would also send in reports to them, things that concerned them that they wanted to folks look into. And this archive has been opened. It's now available online. And what's wild is you can look at, somebody writes a letter. You can look at the letterhead, and you can see who all the people are in that good white organization who are wanting to do things. So one of the things I did was I was able to cross-reference. This is, the structure of my talk is completely gone now. I was able to cross-reference the list of elders at good white first churches with the lists of informers to, the Sovereignty Commission. John Reed Miller, one of the most famous and venerated Presbyterian ministers in town, there are records of him having secret meetings with the Sovereignty Commission on how they could bust up boycotts that were hurting white businesses and so on. Where was I going with all that? I have no idea. So maybe we can think also about generational, the sort of generational effect on the society. Anyway, this organization, they had this big rally in Memorial Stadium, and one gentleman who Lee Paris, who if you read the stuff. He was a young white businessman who was very fired up by this whole thing. And he had this idea, he called it a vision, of the black and white ministers raising the cross together. If they gathered in repentance around the cross, this was a great symbol of unity. And so this rather odd thing happened on the playing field at Memorial Stadium, where all these guys in blazers raised the cross like they're on Iwo Jima. And this was the kind of one of the center points of the rally, and there were all kinds of photographs of this. I found this kind of interesting as well, because this is the very same place where Ross Barnett, when he was resisting the Meredith integration, stood up and said, "I love Mississippi, I love her people. I love her customs. And everyone was like, the closest thing to a Nazi rally, if you see the footage. And this is sort of in the same place. So if we're thinking in terms of theological drama, this is interesting to me. Now, Mission Mississippi kind of carried on, and they kept having these annual big events that became less and less well-attended. And they ended up focusing on this idea of building relationship, changing Mississippi one relationship at a time. So they've become very creative. They got all kinds of restaurants in Jackson to give people discounts. They called them two and two nights. So if a couple came with another couple of a different race, they didn't like allow for kind of interracial dating, I guess, in that stuff. But if you would get a discount. They'd encourage picnics. They encouraged church partnerships. And they have prayer breakfasts every week in Jackson before the start of the workday to try and bring folks together. And they've been... I've got some photographs of these prayer breakfasts. I went to a lot of them. Sometimes the food was really, really good, normally in black churches. And white churches, you'd get the worst one was the cold Chick-fil-A sandwiches. But it was meeting around food. That does a cold Chick-fil-A sandwich. Yeah. Like the sausage, the chicken biscuit. It wasn't good. I researched that for you. You don't have to do it. And at various times, news agencies have... this is a picture from the AP. There have been, you know, feature articles about, you know, interesting things are happening in Jackson, Mississippi. And here's a photograph I took. The meetings always end in a prayer huddle, praying for the people who are running the ministry. And now, it doesn't just meet in churches. They meet in the offices of the Clarion Ledger, the newspaper. They meet in schools to pray for schools and so on. So that's a very interesting kind of dynamic. And they always end in this huddle, praying for each other. Do you want to take a quick break and then... Do you not care? What do you want to do? I won't ask them because they'll want to run away. No?
Yeah, I mean, we can do either
I can keep going.
Yeah, let's... You want to take a quick break? Yeah, and Lee Paris was my college classmate.
He was your college classmate. Well, I'm about to say something. Oh, well, in that case, can you stay just for a moment?
Ralph Eubanks, who is a Mississippian, a distinguished writer, good friend.
Now
the editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review.
Lee Paris is two slides away, and I'd like you to see this, because this was a great moment.
Okay,
so
let's get through.
Okay, I'm going to get there. Here we go. Actually, maybe not two slides away. They're still going. Mission Mississippi is still going. They're still expanding. They've got chapters in 25 cities in Mississippi. Their latest initiative is a bit weird. They teamed up with Fellowship of Christian Athletes to carry an illuminated cross around the state. And my friends at the University of Mississippi, Lee Paris asked, could they bring the illuminated cross onto the field? And they were like, burning crosses? Don't. We're not too cool with the symbolism. Maybe not a good idea. But that didn't stop them. It didn't go. Anyway, I want to think about if you change perspective on your drama and you think about end times, not the end times, that's very eschatological. You think about when things end and start. If you take a perspective on the civil rights movement and lots of you have been writing about massive resistance. If you take that white perspective on massive resistance, and see from the white, this massive resistance point of view, did they succeed in stopping the effects of Brown versus Board? Were they successful? You maybe get a different perspective. I'll introduce this. One of the things I noticed very quickly in studying Mission Mississippi, is there was no mention of justice. completely absent. And if any of you have done any reading in theologies of reconciliation, or even, you know, secular understandings of reconciliation, that justice is absolutely central. And so to have an organization which is about Christian reconciliation, but this word isn't mentioned. So I talked to Lee Paris. I was staying in his house, so I was trying to be very polite. What's the deal? When you interview people, the questions that are likely to get them to shut you off, you leave till the end. That's your last question you ask. So I asked him, what's the deal? And he said, for me, justice is God's job and the laws of our land's job. I guess that's not a calling on my life to seek justice. That's God's job and the laws. Justice isn't, I'm not supposed to do anything. So that's a teaser. We can talk about it later. But so that set me off on what turned into the most fruitful part of my study, which is like, where does this idea come from? Because this is a guy who has put his life and his money where his mouth is. He absolutely firmly believes in racial reconciliation as he understands it. It has caused him a lot of social awkwardness in his nice, smooth southern world. So he's not frightened of taking a stand, but where does this idea come from that justice isn't really what we're supposed to be about? there's a teaser trailer. Let's take a
great,
quick
thank
break.
You. Awesome.
So going back, I just wanted to get to this slide. But going back to this idea of what happens if we try and shift our perspective. Let's try and imagine we're nice little white supremacists, and we see, and we're white supremacists in Mississippi, and we see the civil rights movement as this kind of invasion of outside agitators who are trying to mess up our southern way of life. And that you've got this slow kind of pressure going at the same time from the federal courts to integrate your schools. And if you do that, then your kind of periods change, right? So you might have 1954 to 1964 would be bitter end resistance. So we've got experts in people who know a lot more about massive resistance right now than I do. So that's bitter end resistance. That's when in Charlottesville, you know, you shut your school if it looks like there's a threat that an African-American child will come in. But by 1964, the Citizens Council, are recognizing that this isn't gonna fly. They've lost that battle. The federal government is determined. And so now we get a period of what you could call strategic accommodation. And in Mississippi, Paul Johnson, the governor, when he was elected, in his speech, he said, "If I must fight, it will not be a rearguard defense of yesterday." It's not that funny, Charles.
No, I'm sorry.
White supremacy isn't very funny.
No, I was complimenting my student on his photographic memory.
Okay. So. Well, that's good. Well done. I'll start again. Paul Johnson, who was elected governor of Mississippi, said, "If I must fight, it will not be a rearguard defense of yesterday. It will be an all-out assault for our share of tomorrow." This marked a kind of change. And that year, August 1964, the Citizens Council opened the excitingly named Council School Number 1. Sounds sort of Stalinist, doesn't it? It wasn't that attractive. It actually didn't get enough students the first year, and they closed it and reopened it. But the September issue that year, 1964, of The Citizen, which was the Citizens Council's magazine, was entirely devoted to how to start a public school. So you get this shift in 1964, and so you see the growth of what are called Christian academies. Lots of them are called Christian academies, the slang was calling them seg academies. Schools were forced to desegregate in 1970 in Mississippi, I believe. And I believe that you were part of...
Yeah, Ralph and I were part of the first...
The Invisible Man.
...class, that's right. There had been freedom of choice under the 64 Civil Rights Act, but took another Supreme Court decision, Alexander versus Holmes County, to finally force the hands of local school districts with the threat of federal dollars withdrawn if there weren't plans implemented by the fall of 1970 for desegregation of schools.
Of the schools. Yeah. So... With this move in 1970, you get an explosion of these academies. Existing private school, white private schools, their enrollment goes through the roof, and you get new schools starting. And this is the very respectable badge of the Jackson Preparatory School, started in 1970. Jackson Prep is a very big white high school in Jackson, Mississippi. And you get, I mean, nationally, this is when busing starts in urban centers. So we get another move. And then, I'm not an expert in this, but if you look through the legislation, stuff starts getting rolled back in the 1980s. And it's seen as a kind of a reversal of some of those things. So now, when I did some research into this for this talk, it's not correct to say that desegregation has been reversed, but it's returned to the 1967 levels, which doesn't sound good to me, but there you have it. There's another, and I wrote about this, one of the sections of my book that I sent you, is, so when we're thinking about, okay, let's talk about justice. Let's talk about justice in the context of Mississippi. Let's talk about justice in terms of Jackson, Mississippi. Another way that whites thwarted the desegregation was white flight from the cities. You take yourself out of the school district and you move to a different one. Now, white flight does all kinds of other things to the city, but if we're just using this lens of who won the issue over schools, this was a way of resegregating the schools in Jackson. And now, if you know Jackson, Mississippi, the schools are almost perfectly segregated in the city. There are very few. There's very little racial diversity in those schools. I've got a stat. This is from Wikipedia, so it must be true. Murrah High School, which was the main white high school, the big white high school in Jackson, is currently 93.52% African American now, almost completely a monoracial school. So it's in this context. Also, when you have white flight, your tax base leaves. You lose a lot of the taxes in the city. In Jackson now, if a water main bursts, you might have to wait a long time till they fix the water main, because the city is really struggling financially. So we had this this quote. "For me, justice is God's job and the law of our land's job. And I guess that's not a calling on my life to seek justice. That's God's job and the laws." There are a few things that are interesting here, by the way. One of them that I didn't write about in my book, but sociologists pick up on, is this idea of calling. This is a very clever device. If there's anyone here who's evangelical, you'll recognize this. When Jesus says, you know, sell all you have and give your money to the poor and come follow me, seems fairly clear. I don't like it. I don't do it, but Jesus said it. But a device in evangelical churches and other churches too is they'll say, yeah, that's not my calling. I mean, if the Lord calls you to that, that's really good, but that isn't my calling. So it's interesting that he uses this language of calling. But what he's appealing to, actually, I discovered, is a Southern Presbyterian doctrine called the spirituality of the church. And the spirituality of the church, I ran into this. So, okay, here's a photograph of, this was in the Clarion Ledger. This was a promotional photograph for the first, advertising the first Mission Mississippi meeting. And this is what was interesting. Here are the white guys. They're all in the, we've got two businessmen and a Presbyterian minister are the white guys. And turns out they're all part of the PCA, Presbyterian Church of America denomination. So I realized early on that this one church in, this one particular church in Jackson, Mississippi, was particularly significant for white involvement in this movement. And as you can tell, they're hurting for cash. That's actually, they'd had some architectural work done, and the architect's website, that's their photograph, so they it doesn't kind of shine like that normally. You're like, oh, come here, give us your money. But it's a big church, very powerful. And so I did some research into the history of this particular congregation and this particular denomination. This particular church is very significant in the history of this denomination, the Presbyterian Church in America. This was a church that split from the Southern Presbyterians, the PCUS, in, it was sort of slow motion leaving, but it finalized in about 1973. And they really split over this issue of race. From my research, that seems quite clear that what they didn't like were the liberal pronouncements from the denomination, from the General Assembly, talking about race, talking about, and they these kind of liberal ideas that were being forced on them. And what they said was, this isn't the church's business. These political views, this isn't what church is supposed to be about. This is the spirituality of the church. I trace it back to actually the Presbyterians' defense of slavery, Southern Presbyterians' defense of slavery. And then you can trace it all the way through maintaining white supremacy. One of the nice things about this church is it was founded in 1837, which is the same year that the Presbyterians, the old school Presbyterians in the United States, kicked out the new school over the issue of slavery. So the history of this church is nicely, like, maps onto that. So anyway, the doctrine of the spirituality of the church goes something like this. The church's ordained role is spiritual, faithfully preaching the word and administering the sacraments. That's what the church should be about. It should not get sidetracked by any other business, particularly the church, as the church should not address the state or endorse or condemn society's programs. And if you read kind of contemporary PCA literature, an example is given all the time. It's a really weird one. Is, okay, so you have fundraisers to raise money for your church, but what happens if someone says, we should have a used car lot in front of the church? Is the church's business to sell cars? No, of course not. That's not spirits. We have to have the spirituality of the church so we stay on our mission. So how does this doctrine work to defend white supremacy? It's fairly obvious, right? You guys are smart. Well, if any church issues a statement calling for you to change what you're doing, you simply condemn them for being political and not spiritual. It's great. In 1861, Thornwell says to the Northern Presbyterians, shame on you for telling us that, for getting all bent out of shape about the issue of slavery. That's a political issue. By you guys are being so political, you're not even really being the church anymore. We're being the true church. So you take the spiritual high ground whilst managing to keep doing the things that you wanted to do anyway. In 1957, 3 years after Brown versus Board, the year that President Eisenhower had to send the army to Little Rock, the session at First Pres, as they call themselves, issued this statement. The session does not feel that the Presbyterian Church in the United States should take any action with reference to current social, political, and economic problems. An organized church should exist only for the purpose of stimulating and strengthening its members and for coordinating and implementing their activities and bringing others to know him and serve him. In other words, our members are going to continue to support segregation, and you're wrong to challenge us. It's interesting that you had the David Chappelle reading. I didn't have any hand in that, and Charles apparently stuck that in there at the beginning of the semester. But I have in my book, I have a real bone to pick with David Chappelle. He creates his historical narrative, and his thesis is that the black church had this kind of prophetic religion. Why is the civil rights movement so successful? Because they had prophetic religion on their side. And what is the white church? What are the white churches doing? They're not really doing anything, he says. They don't take a significant part in the civil rights movement. They sort of fail. The white churches fail to really support white supremacy. And so this is why the civil rights movement is successful. And that's just mental. I don't know what history he's reading. First of all, you know, that's true if you end in 1968. But if you see the white churches and their involvement in thwarting the desegregation of schools, in the establishing of segregationist academies, they're taking an active role in resisting the civil rights movement. And now this is interesting. This is First Presbyterian Day School. Look when it's established. What a coincidence. Right when the Citizens' Council said that you should start your own schools. Oh, and, if there's a little sarcasm in my voice, you know, they have directors of Jackson Citizens' Council who are elders who were advising them to start the school. Now, they don't say that, and we have somebody whose mom teaches at this school. Present here. That isn't part of their narrative. If you look at their history, it's because prayer wasn't allowed in schools anymore, so they started the school. But the coincidence is just too, and you know, but the racial diversity, though, is impressive. I feel like it's late. I'm a little overtired, and I'm getting sarcastic, so I apologize for what's going on here. But so first of all, David Chappelle, oh my gosh, this is being videoed. Ignore everything I just said. David Chappelle says, you know, the white churches didn't play a significant role in resisting the civil rights movement. I think that's nonsense. I think they played a very significant role. One, in establishing these schools, but also because he doesn't understand what kind of religion you want. If you're powerless, or no, you're not powerless, if you're oppressed, your power lies in your collective voice. And in the black community, one of the places that collective voice has expression is from the church. And this is where you see these prophetic characters, and he's right, he's recognizing this prophetic voice from the church. If you're white and you're in power, you don't want prophetic religion. You actually don't want your minister telling you what to do with your money. You don't want your minister telling you what to do with your investments. You don't want him telling you what to do if you're a lawyer and you're going to court. You actually want your minister to say, all of that stuff, that's your business. It's up to your individual Christian conscience what you do. The church is about, you know, preaching the word. You know, we'll preach for an hour. We'll have an expository sermon for an hour. And we know that we're being the church. And when I traced, it was interesting if you look at the bit of the book I sent you, you can trace who these elders are at the First Presbyterian Church. They are one of the main judges in Jackson. He presided over the two trials of Byron de la Beckwith that both just went horribly wrong. You have directors of the Citizens' Council. These, you know, to say that the church, you know, Sunday school lesson, one of the first Sunday school lessons you have is, who is the church? What is the church? Is the church a building? No, the church are the people. So if you want to know how the white churches were resisting the civil rights movement, what were the people doing? And when your elders are the people in power, I think it's completely legitimate to say, if you have in someone like Bob Canada, one of the attorneys for the city of Jackson, who is fighting desegregation of schools, I think it's reasonable to say that that's the church is involved, especially when you have this nice doctrine in place which says the church, as the church, can't say anything to you about what you should do politically or what you should do socially. So this is what I discovered. And this, I mean, I traced sort of this influence on Mission Mississippi. And so the old guard in the white church, particularly in First Presbyterian Church, said, we'll give you our support, but you must make sure that this doesn't become political, because then it stops being Christian. Now, what was then interesting to me was, if that was obvious to me, as a guy from England who is spending a few months studying this organization, this must be abundantly clear to the people working in the organization. And the African-American leadership in Mission Mississippi, particularly this guy, this is Dolphus Weary, have a whole background in community development work, in understanding issues of systemic injustice, understanding the role the church should play in that. They're disciples, if you like, of a guy called John Perkins, who is a sort of radical evangelical kind of social gospeler, is actually how I would think of him. So what Dolphus Weary had been made the director of Mission Mississippi. And how did he feel about this absence of the word justice? And he talks a lot, or used to talk a lot, about Mission Mississippi as Reconciliation 101. It's just getting in at the door. And he emphasized, what we do is get people to sit down together. Now, there was an interesting dynamic set up at this point, because the white kind of leadership were just extremely happy to see everyone sitting down together. That to them was, you know, not necessarily mission accomplished, but this is kind of what we're doing. Whereas for people like Dolphus Weary, getting people to sit down at the table was just the starting point. And so in my book, I kind of explore a little bit about how this works and its potential. And one of my conclusions is, until it's acknowledged that there's actually a doctrine in place trying to keep religion from becoming prophetic, then it's going to have an uphill struggle. I feel like I've been talking for a really long time, and my papers are all shuffled, so who knows what's going to happen next. Just sort of by way of conclusion, this is just an example of one reconciliation initiative. It suddenly became very significant. As I was finishing writing this, Katrina hit. And I was thinking, Mission Mississippi isn't really doing anything. Suddenly, Katrina hit, and it became one of the organizations that FEMA used to organize the distribution of aid to the Gulf Coast. Mission Mississippi was able to sort of like activate these networks that it had spent a lot of time creating. And so for me, that was a sort of wind. It takes a storm like Katrina to get these guys to go, oh, we should actually change Mississippi, not just focus just on the one relationship at a time. I think it's a significant, Mission Mississippi is a significant model for churches in the U.S. to start the hard business of addressing the question of race, reconciliation and segregation. They offer a way of building up interracial networks, and sociologists say that it's interracial networks that actually change people's perceptions. Just saying, I have a black friend, or I have a gay friend, or whatever. Sociologists, rather depressingly, have shown that, in fact, that tends to reinforce people's prejudices. What you need to be is you need to be in networks of people who are very different than you, to really start seeing changes in perception. So Mission Mississippi offers a way of building up interracial networks without insisting on having multiracial churches. A slew of sociologists who've studied multiracial congregations suggests that a multiracial congregation currently in America is likely to fail. but that just seems to be true. Too many old wineskins. It's very difficult maintaining a multiracial congregation. And Bill and I could probably have an interesting conversation about that, as both of us were members, or he still is, a member of Trinity Episcopal Church, which is a multiracial congregation. In fact, that's one of the exceptions, I would say, for some interesting reasons. Now, the danger of this model is that whites feel pleased with themselves, self-righteous, and forget or were never told that simply meeting for conversation and prayer with someone from a different church, different denomination, different socioeconomic background, and even a different race, this is only Reconciliation 101. There are other courses the church must take before it can graduate as the Church of Open Friendship. So that's sort of my conclusion. But I'd like, if you've got any questions, and we have some, then I will happily go off in different directions. Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
So maybe I start off with a comment and then end it with a question. What you're just talking mm-hmm. about, the comment, you know, you're saying, is Mississippi, has it changed? And I'll say, obviously, yes and no. This is an obvious question. I think the first one, why it hasn't changed, is still the political power tends to be predominantly white. I think all the Mississippi representatives, I think except for maybe Benny Thompson, are white. Both senators are white. The governor is white. And now, recently, in the past 2 to 4 years, those racial lines have been reinscribed through conservative ideology of Tea Party. That's really... it's really hard. I mean, The Atlantic just had a 12-page thing on the failure of Obamacare in Mississippi, and it tends to fall more or less on racial lines. So unfortunately, there's still a lot of work there. But yes, there's a lot of change. I think one of the main ones is that, ironically, James Meredith actually goes to a PCA church.
Right.
That a PCA church that was started by First Press. And there are racial reconciliation. So I don't know how that works.
I can talk to that.
Yeah, maybe
is that your question?
That could be a question. That's a question. And so then my actual question is, with that, you know, the reconciliation, it seems that the reconciliation that is going on tends to be a white conception of reconciliation. Do the African American leaders and those in power, and like John Perkins, do they recognize that without justice that this is a sort of a white understanding? Does it fall on racial lines?
Because
it seems like it would, and I think and if that is raised, then I think that could be helpful, but maybe they won't see it as helpful because it's just reinscribing the divisions where they're trying so hard to bridge, so it makes it even trickier.
Okay. Lots of really good, there's a lot of stuff in there. So I want to keep the answer to be somehow generally applicable. I could really dig into Jackson, the weird dynamics of Jackson, Mississippi. So first of all, absolutely, the African-American participants in Mission Mississippi understand the problems of and the issues of justice, and they recognize that this is not being met. And in fact, John Perkins, rather unfortunately, he stole a copy of my book. I was at a book table at CCDA, and he came up and said thank you and walked off. And the book guy at the book table goes, yeah, he does that. It's his conference, right? His conference. So he believes that all the books in the bookstore are his. But he read enough of my book to get very mad at Dollfuss. And this caused quite a lot of friction between people involved with Voice of Calvary and John Perkins, who'd returned. And so I found myself in the slightly awkward position of having I don't think I precipitated it. I think it was a fight that was waiting to happen. And my book was used as something to hit him with. And I've been back to Jackson a couple of times since then with students, and it's been very interesting seeing that playing out. And one of the things is that my understanding is that that a curriculum is being written to work with white churches to bring in the question of justice and reconciliation. This is an interesting story. So one of the churches that I researched that didn't get in the book because it was just too complicated, but I'll try and do it very briefly now, is on Northside Drive. It's a classic story. There's a white, beautiful white Presbyterian church, a church plant from First Pres, called Trinity. They're all called, like, they're all got the same names, so it's very confusing with PCA churches. Trinity Presbyterian, and they're in a, what they euphemistically call a transitioning neighborhood. So, in other words, white flight and African-American community folks are moving in the neighborhood. So this church got a vision for serving the neighborhood. Again, more euphemisms. But this was, they had drunk the John Perkins' Kool-Aid, the CCDA Kool-Aid. They wanted to serve the local people, whatever color they were. And there's a seminary in Jackson, RTS Seminary, and some of these fired-up young seminarians thought this was great, and so they went to that church on purpose. And the church said, we're never going to move from this neighborhood. We're going to serve this neighborhood. Until a large Baptist church moved from the other side of the Beltway, from the other side of 55, and offered to sell it to Trinity at really low cost, relatively. And so rather than expand their church, which was going to be expensive, they decided to move. This is where it gets complicated. This white church decided to move out of the neighborhood following white flight, even though they said, we're not about that. So about a third of their congregation that were absolutely committed to this idea of serving the local community said, well, we're going to stay. So this is where it got complicated. The church that stayed Trinity left, and the people who left Trinity stayed in their church building. You following me so far? Okay. So the people who stayed were advised, if you want to be, and they decided they wanted to be a multiracial congregation, which is statistically very difficult to do, particularly if your denomination, which has prided itself on being super white. They were told, to be a black church, you need to have a black minister. At the end of the day, no one's going to believe you, you know, for a moment. And so they called a remarkable preacher called Mike Campbell. And this church has been going, Trinity Pres is now kind of like the poster child for the PCA of a multiracial... Redeemer Prez is now kind of a poster child for this. And in the research I'm doing at the moment on congregational singing, I got to sing in their choir for a bit. That was kind of fun. So this is the weird part. So James Meredith is absolutely fascinated by the idea that here's a church where white people who are graduates of Old Miss and are frat boys are going to church with African Americans. So he started going to that church. So I had also the very like bizarre and exciting experience of going to the church and the Sunday school hour, and there was James Meredith, and I was like, Mr. Meredith, I don't have a Sunday school group. Can I come to Sunday school with you? So I got to sit in a classroom with James Meredith, which was, I didn't know that was on my bucket list, but to sit next to James Meredith in a classroom in a chair like this, was pretty exciting. That didn't really answer any questions at all, but it allowed me to tell the story.
So, like, how did he end up there? I mean, that kind of...
Well, James Meredith is a very interesting guy. He ended up there with this fascination to see how a white, like white establishment Jackson is now interacting with African Americans. It's also, if you are PCA here, it's a very intellectual tradition. So even the fact that their class, you know, the Sunday school is very much classroom lecture-y type thing, I think appeals to him a lot. And probably he likes it because people go, what are you doing here? And he's kind of, that's his MO. I think they said that to him a lot when he went to the University of Mississippi. Yeah.
How much do you think just the, you know, economics fits into everything? So at least with where I'm from, we have drastically different, standards of living across the city. Mm-hmm. That you can walk two blocks, mm-hmm, and you go from the richest neighborhood to the poorest. Mm-hmm. But in each neighborhood, there's a church. So churches are they are based on race lines, but those race lines are also based on income levels. So, you know, how much of it could be, like, you just stop building so many churches. And if you make people from, you know, three different neighborhoods, I'm sure it's not that simple, but it would be great if it were.
In Mississippi, they'd be like, a church shortage. Oh, no. That would actually be, like, a massive moment of concern.
Like, Jewish background, I'm like, I don't know, there's like one temple and everyone goes to it because that's all you get. Like, you only get one.
So get along.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, that's your only option. And if you don't, then you just leave. Like,
so,
you just don't.
So Emerson, I mean, that's interesting. Emerson, in his research, shows the smaller the religious group, the greater the diversity of the congregation. So if you're Jewish and there's one place you can go, that's where you go. If you're Buddhist, then it's going to be even more diverse, right? In Mississippi, where there's, this is the effect of the market, when there is so much choice, you can find the place where everyone looks exactly like you, and they drive the same car. No churches are proposing that will reduce the number. Like, what would be the opposite of church planting?
Merging.
Yeah, only like dying congregations suggest that. So, and that is a problem when you have this proposal of church partnerships. And this is interesting for who's doing Trinity and Christ Church. Church partnerships between black and white churches worked best when the churches were completely different. So, a white Episcopalian church with a black Pentecostal church. Because there was no sense that one church was going to try and take over the other. And we all know which the way that goes. African Americans are very rightly suspicious that when white people want to get involved, they want to take over. First Baptist Church and Second Baptist Church find it very hard to have anything to do with each other. And I'll say one other thing which you might find interesting, and that's the Jewish dimension of this. So one thing I didn't say that is I find very interesting is this guy, Lee Paris, he's a Delta boy, brought up in Indianola, went to the University of Mississippi. He's got six generations of Mississippians in his family. His father was Mr. Old Miss or Colonel Reb or something, and he was a cheerleader at Old Miss, and he had Colonel Reb yard ornaments. He bought a big house in Jackson and he put white columns on it. He's so excited to be a white Mississippian. He's really excited to be a Presbyterian. No, he is. Like, he would, if Lee Paris was here, he would say, I am super excited to be a white Mississippian. His mother is Presbyterian. His father is Jewish. When his parents came to marry, even though his father was like Mr. Old Miss, no church in the state would marry them. They got married in a sorority house, which sounds like a bad movie. And he has since funded, the Paris family has funded building a chapel at the University of Mississippi where people can have like interdenominational, interreligious weddings. He went to his father's rabbi when they were setting up Mission Mississippi to say, is it okay if we're just going to be about Christians? And so he's kind of interested. So even though he's very excited, I was talking before with, help me, your friend Ralph. Thank you. Ralph, who was in Lee Paris's class at the university. I was just talking about this. So, you know, on one level, he is like super white Mississippian. He says, I think you read the quote, you know, I'm from the Delta, I went to the right fraternity, I'm from the University of Mississippi, I vote Republican, I'm Protestant, you know, I'm an insider, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews, if you like. But at the same time, he knows that it's very interesting, he knows that his family has been not accepted in this closed society. So I think that ambivalence is probably playing out, actually.
I guess I can't defend him now, but...
I used this photograph, by the way, sorry, because I love it, because it was a candid photograph, and his ties... he's like an excited guy, and I sort of captured that, whereas all his official photographs, he's very staid.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, actually.
Yeah.
So, with the seersucker, but... So, you just said that it was explicitly Christian. He went to the rabbi and said, is it cool if we just maintain our Christian club, essentially? But I'm wondering, how they interact with the rest of the community and if they do. So, I mean, I've never been to Mississippi, but I'm not exactly imagining a lot of mosques or Mormon chapels or, you know, Buddhist sanctuaries or anything like that. Is there any sort of pan-religious or ecumenical outside of the Christian churches? How does Mission Mississippi interact with that?
They explicitly don't. I mean, they don't aggressively not talk to other folks. They're very clear. Our mission is about reconciliation in Christ. It only makes sense if we're having reconciliation in Christ. And that's what we're celebrating. So it's calling on Christians to do that. Now, African-American leaders who are leaders in Mission Mississippi, people aren't just, you know, contained in one silo. Lots of them are involved in the Amos Network, which is pan-religious. That said, there are not many people who aren't Christian in Mississippi, and they're more Baptists than everyone else put together. 55% of people in Mississippi self-identify as Baptist. You gave that one up a long time ago. So, I mean, you know, you've sort of got to appreciate that the way that dynamic plays out. I mean, it's pretty wild. So, you know, it's not unusual for big businesses to sort of open the day in prayer. And lots of the big donors to Mission Mississippi are like the Mississippi Power and Light, you know, company gives money. And yeah.
So you had said earlier, through the quote of Will Campbell, that the prophetic edge needs the conserving edge, or that they're somehow connected.
Yeah.
But then later on, I seemed to get the sense that you were saying that the conserving edge is always necessarily an antagonistic relationship to the prophetic edge, because it can never itself be prophetic, because it's caught up in an idea of spirituality that precludes itself from ever thinking that this activity is in some way political. So I'm wondering, how should we think about that? Should we think that there is some relationship there, or is that necessarily going to fail? And then also, do you know, I know this is a second part, but let's say Pentecostal churches in the South that maybe do break this idea, or also, I'm just thinking that we've talked about this quite a bit in class, that there would have been plenty of liberal African-American churches that would have wanted nothing to do with King's work in the civil rights. So how do we also bring that in?
That's a lot of questions. Okay, so the first one, there's this tension between the prophetic church that Will Campbell talks about and this conserving edge. I think what Will Campbell saw is what King talked about, and I haven't memorized the quote, but something to the effect of, you know, legislation will only get you so far, you know, but you need to, for reconciliation, you need to change hearts. And what Will Campbell saw was, you know, the civil rights movement was this kind of really hard shove over the cliff. He didn't like some of the arrogance that he saw in the civil rights workers, the dismissal of, I guess from his perspective, the lack of love for the cracker and the redneck. And he would use those terms. What you see with Mission Mississippi, in a sense, is a rather flawed attempt to sort of kind of catch up to recognizing that the church is damaged, incomplete, in need of reconciliation, this kind of sorting out, you know, cleaning up the mess that they themselves have created. But it's incomplete because there's always but you're right, there's always this resistance of the prophetic. So maybe it's always two steps forward, one step back.
This is what engenders the great disappointment in some ways at the end of 68. What leads in so many ways to the turn of the stick is a real devastation that this hasn't worked in some ways. So, I mean, don't they need each other even at this level?
Well, I mean, I think they absolutely.
Is the conserving always needing to become prophetic?
Well, this is where we're in the realm of theological drama. You know, theologically, how do we make sense of this? If we look at the life of the church over a period, You know, what do we do with that? The church, so many churches were so complicit in white supremacy, very actively supporting it. Then the same people, some of the same people, so in the 90s, whatever, 30 years later, they're the old men who are encouraging these young guys, you really need to go forward with this. I mean, I don't actually have an answer. I mean, there's great tragedy here. And even these best efforts are so kind of hampered by the kind of intellectual and spiritual toolkit that these guys have inherited from, and political, right, that they've inherited. And so you said, you know, in Mississippi, it's political. The political question is holding things back. I'm pointing to the guy who isn't here. One of the things, so I did my research before Obama was elected. And I went back and was talking to folks in Mission Mississippi of the impact of Obama winning that election. And they had some chapters that just collapsed as a result of this. Whites in these prayer, they'd been meeting and praying at breakfast, you know, once a week for a couple of years or something. And then Obama wins the election, and whites left the table. You're gloating. You know, this isn't Christian. You're.
So what happened in those instances?
The whites left. They couldn't. This was too much. They couldn't. It challenged them too much to see. I'm feeling like I'm not saying anything very coherent.
No.
But that was very interesting. I mean, and the sense that just how difficult it is to have everyone sitting down at a table at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So how had those political differences been negotiated before?
Well, when you're winning, you don't have to. You don't. If you're white and you've got, you know, an administration that looks like you, then it's not too much of a challenge.
But in other contexts, the interracialism was the same despite political differences into a new administration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's arising during the Clinton era. Maybe it's a matter of Southern and Northern, really, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Actually, like all across the country, white supremacist groups and hate crimes went on a significant rise after after Obama's election, particularly because we've been in this post-racial racist era since probably the mid-90s, and that results in everything being okay as long as you don't have to address race. But really, it's just saying that as long as we ignore it, it's like the power structures will stay the same. Obama's election was a direct threat to those power structures, and you saw it propel plenty of racism inside of and outside of the church.
That's right.
I also wanted to ask, well, one, to really respond just directly to this quote by Lee Paris, because just biblically speaking, it's completely false.
It's incoherent. That's exactly right.
In that the only two jobs from a Protestant perspective of Christians, really, is to, one, believe that God died for you, that Jesus died on the cross for your sins, and to, two, with that knowledge, go and spread his word and his message.
The type of brand of Protestantism.
Yeah, okay, one brand. My brand of Protestantism.
Okay, that's good. Cool.
And so, like, that discipleship is very much so a part of it. But I guess what I really want to ask is, what is he considering to be justice? And, in, I guess, operationalized terms. And I think that if we get to that, it would really explain a lot of why he's not willing to see it.
When he says justice, he is thinking of programs. I mean, the extreme end of what he conceives of is, will people demand reparations? That would be the nightmare, you know, We're white Christians. I'm persuading folks from my white church to be a part of this organization and to put their money into it And we've invited, we've got, you know, African-American church leaders here. And as James Baird, who is a minister of First Presbyterian Church, said, the dangerous thing is you can't control those other people. When you're a minister, he said, in a big white church, you want to control everything. You don't want to go outside. So Mission Mississippi was a very big risk for these guys, because what happens if this African-American church leader stands up and starts sounding like James Cone? That would be terrible, and it would be socially so embarrassing. And I would be seen as being this kind of black activist radical, but I'm not. And I know that so for him, justice, you know, demanding rights, this kind of more militant, justice means being militant. Because he's white, justice, no, that's what goes on in the courts. And he's quite happy with that, because that works for him and his people. Does that sort of answer the question? Well, he doesn't see it. I mean, this again is not a surprise in Mississippi. The white business leaders who are part of this organization are Republicans, and the way they recognized Mississippi needed changing, so they wanted to mentor young black entrepreneurs to start businesses. That's how they saw, and you know, there's some good reason behind that. They wanted to. They recognized that there were glass ceilings. They recognized that a lot of business happened on the golf course, that a lot of, you know, these backroom deals, and they wanted to start making friends with African-American leaders and bringing them into those closed groups. And then they thought that this would bring about change. And in some ways it does slightly, but not especially for.
How involved is his father or Judaism in his life? Just because, like, social justice is, you know, it is like a main tenet of Judaism.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. Like, Tikkun Olam is, like, that's your goal in life, is to repair things and to heal the world, which is, you know, why, you know, a lot of the reason for the Jewish involvement. But, like, I can just imagine him going to a rabbi and, you know, him saying, like, I only want this to focus on Christians, which makes sense because, like, not very many Jews in Mississippi. But if he said, like, this to a rabbi, I can imagine a rabbi.
He'd get a slap.
Like, what are you talking about?
So one interesting thing is Lee Paris preaches once a year at his father's synagogue. Spirituality of the church is actually way more sophisticated. It goes like this. He would say, It's what the church does as the church. The church has no business being involved in politics. The preacher will preach the word and will convict you of what the right things are to do in life, and it's all, you know, personal morality, basically. And then you, as an individual Christian, go out and into your vocation in the world and live as a Christian. But you're not representing the church. Once you start pushing on it, it starts crumbling pretty fast, right? Yeah.
Like, how seriously can we take religious convictions in the civil rights? I know that, like, the flags of Christianity wave and the flags of whatever. But the letter to Birmingham Jail is a direct response to the Good Friday address, which was signed by 3 or 4 rabbis of, like, the 8 people who signed it. And it's like,
boom.
We're really glad that you guys got your laws passed and all, but this marching action is not good. And, like, you can't seek justice this way. It has to come in due time. Like, you guys just need to be patient. And Martin Luther King's like, what the heck is this patience? Right. There's no justice in that. And so, like, how seriously can we take religious convictions? Or are there even religious convictions? And are they just, like, waving flags in their white supremacy? Like, how is that? I just think that, like, Christianity and Judaism are almost insignificant. They're just ways of speaking to maintain their system.
That's not a big question. Well, one of the things is when you look at religion and what Charles says is, first of all, religion, what is religion? You've got to have a real kind of rich understanding of how churches work, how people in their cowardice and their craven ways of protecting their self-interest operate even when they have a sense of religious calling on their lives. What King was responding to were very well-meaning people who were saying, King, don't you see we're making progress in this town? If you come here, we've got these delicate alliances. We think there's things are moving better. If you come here and start having protests, it's going to screw everything up. And, they were slightly right, probably. I said that on film. They had a point. But King was about precipitating these kind of dramatic protests to dramatize the violence of Jim Crow. These religious people didn't want to they didn't want any violence to dramatize anything because violence is bad. Pardon? No, but they were precipitating violence deliberately. They wanted to have, I believe, I think that's fair to say, the violence of Jim Crow racism to be revealed when the dogs were brought out, when the hoses were brought out. So that the press, it was a strategy, so that the press could take these pictures and people could see the photographs and think, my goodness me, this is terrible. I need to do something about it. So how seriously can we take people's religious convictions? I think if you're a historian, let's start with a historical narrative. It is your responsibility to not paint two-dimensional pictures of people. You have to understand them in three dimensions. And their religious convictions and understanding is so connected with their communities, how they respond to things. You've got to understand it. It's also really important from the theological drama side of things when we, for understanding ourselves, in one of the classes I teach, start off watching a movie of Theologians Under Hitler. And the reason I start the class with the Nazis is most people can basically, no one's going to say, no, the Nazis were a good thing, or at least not everybody. Most of my students, anyway, are not about to do a big defense of, Nazis. They know they were bad. And I say, we're going to study all kinds of theological movements that have resisted, oppression and tyranny and so on. And we would like to think that we are, that we would be those prophetic people, that we would stand up against it. But let me tell you, statistically, when you look at any of these movements, most of us would not. We would not be the prophetic figures at all. If, statistics are anything to go by, we would probably just be quiet. And we'd probably go along with the status quo so it doesn't unsettle our lives and our plans. And when you think about theological, that's what the prophets are up against. That's what Amos is up against with the cows of Bashan enjoying their, libations. They're enjoying their lifestyle. And so that's part of the drama. Characters like Will Campbell, who won't leave the church. People like John Perkins, who won't leave the church, despite the very evident hypocrisy, despite the fact that these institutions are really functioning a lot of the time to support the economic status quo. That, for me, is part of what makes it interesting and tragic and challenging.
And that is a fine way to end this wonderful, inspiring.
Thank you.